The Warrior Soul podcast is brought to you by F-Bomb Nutrition. F-Bomb makes delicious portable packets of fats. And I'm always talking about the benefits of a ketogenic diet and a high fat diet. And these guys have solved a significant problem. And that is that it's really hard to get good fats out on the road. That makes doing the ketogenic diet or the paleo diet really hard if you have to travel a lot of the time. So these guys have solved that issue and they're great people. They do everything they can to support veterans and they are an awesome company. So definitely go check them out. Their website is www.dropanfbomb.com and you can get a discount, 20% discount off of your first order if you use the code WARRIORSOUL at checkout. All right, guys, I have to warn you that this is going to be a really long introduction, but it's a long introduction for good reason. There's a significant amount of background information I wanted you to have on this as far as my own opinions on the subject matter discussed. So if you hate long introductions, just jump over to the 10-minute mark and you'll be right into the interview. If you want some background information, then keep listening, but I thought I should warn you. In this episode of the Warrior Soul podcast, we have Dr. Sean Baker. If you've been on the internet lately, particularly around the fitness side of the internet, you've probably seen Sean working out, throwing weights around, and rowing for calories on the Concept 2 rower. He's big, he's strong, he's lean, and he's in amazing shape. He's also over 50 years old, and he holds records in weightlifting and in rowing for calories on the Concept 2 rower. That means his cardiovascular fitness is absolutely outstanding. He's also a United States Air Force veteran, an orthopedic surgeon, and a former professional rugby player. But what's most fascinating about Sean is that he only consumes animal products. In fact, most of that is red meat, something that as recently as last year, scientists said was more unhealthy for you than smoking. But Dr. Baker has been doing this carnivore diet for a year now, and he says he's in the best shape of his life. Not only that, he's been inspiring other people to try it, and they also seem to be getting some great results. Now, it might sound like I'm a fan of the carnivore diet, but I'm actually not. I do have some fundamental disagreements with the implications for long-term health of people who are eating nothing but beef. And my reasons, well, I've got a few different reasons for them, but it's not because I believe that eating meat is unhealthy. In fact, I consume grass-fed beef regularly. I practice a ketogenic diet. It's very high fat, very low carb, and moderate in protein. But I also include 8 to 10 cups of leafy green vegetables in my eating regimen every single day. And the reason for this is to keep both my digestion healthy by feeding the bacteria in my intestinal tract, those friendly bacteria in my gut microbiome, and by providing a good source of nutrients. Dr. Baker, on the other hand, believes that you can get all the nutrients you need from eating meat. And in fact, us eating other things actually increases our need for vitamins. And he also believes that the science surrounding the gut microbiome and gut bacteria is questionable at best, and that we actually don't necessarily need to worry about our gut bacteria. Now, I've had a lot of other experts on this podcast. I've had Dr. Terry Walls. I've had Dr. Rodney Dietrich. Dr. Terry Walls is a big advocate for a form of the paleo diet called the Walls Protocol, and she includes a lot of leafy green vegetables in her diet, and this method has helped me significantly with my ulcerative colitis. I've also had amazing results from supplementing with probiotic bacteria and by including probiotic-rich foods, such as fermented foods like raw sauerkraut and kimchi in my diet as well. And I don't feel good when I don't eat vegetables. But again, none of this means that I'm right. The scientific studies do add support to what I'm saying. They also say that the heterocyclic amines that come from charred meat in particular, they're known carcinogens, and their effects in causing cancer are ameliorated by the inclusion of probiotics, meaning that probiotics can help to reduce the inflammation that these carcinogens induce on the intestinal tract. But despite the fact that I disagree with Sean on the diet and the fact that I disagree with Sean on the vegetables, we agree on a lot of different things, such as the fact that sugar is absolutely ruining our society, and so is processed food. It also means that, you know, just because science is saying something, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's right. Science is never a definitive answer. It is a search for the truth. And what Sean is doing is pushing the envelope. And I definitely applaud that, because for so long, we lived with things like the food pyramid, which were obviously wrong, but nobody ever thought to change them or question them. And Sean is questioning the system. He's questioning our known knowledge of nutrition, and he's inviting people into his study, N equals many. And I definitely applaud this, because he's actually inviting people to debunk him. The other cool part about the study that he's running is that if it gets large enough and this study is conducted in a proper manner, it could lead to an answer to the question as to whether or not meat is actually unhealthy. Most of the studies that have been done that say meat is unhealthy have actually not really accounted for confounding variables very well. For instance, we don't know that the people who are consuming lots of meat, whether or not they tend to smoke, whether or not they tend to drink, whether or not they tend to eat high sugary foods or processed foods or foods high in omega-6 fatty acids. None of this has been accounted for, and Sean's study could definitely be a beginning of us understanding the impact of meat consumption on the human body a little bit better. So at the end of the day, I really don't want you to take me having Sean on the podcast as completely advocating for the carnivore diet, but I also don't want you to take this introduction as a criticism of Sean. I actually think Sean is a great guy, and we agree on many, many different things. And at the end of the day, I think we are on the same side here. I just thought that it would be intellectually dishonest of me to put this interview out without expressing my reservations about the theory behind the diet. This was an interview, not a debate, so we're not going head to head here. My purpose was simply to get Sean to express his views, to acknowledge his service as a veteran of the United States Air Force, and to have a conversation about this, so that we could get our listeners a better understanding of what the carnivore diet is and how it might work. Sean's a fascinating guy. He is an amazing athlete, and I definitely think you guys should check him out to learn more beyond listening to this interview. So this was a really long introduction. I'm sorry about that, guys, but I had to get my views out there on this. And with that, let's get into this interview with Dr. Sean Baker.
This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason: to live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast.
Welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here today with Dr. Sean Baker. Now, Dr. Baker has gained a lot of publicity lately for his method of eating. He is a carnivore. He eats mostly red meat, adds a little bit of eggs and some cheese in there as well. But he's been around the podcast circuit, around the internet, and he's been talking about this diet. And we're going to get into that with him. But Dr. Baker's also a veteran, and he served proudly. I believe it's with the United States Air Force, right? Right, Sean?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I did too. I basically was in twice, both times in the Air Force. I was in and then out and then in again.
both as a enlisted and an officer, correct?
No, I was I was an officer the whole time. I was a staff sergeant for a short time while I was in training, but I mean, I basically was a, I came in as a lieutenant and left as a lieutenant colonel, but I was an officer.
Gotcha. Yeah. And a few other things about Sean. He's also he holds a few weightlifting records. He holds a record on the rower, I believe, the Concept 2 rower. He's over 50 years old. He's a stud, lifting massive amounts of weights, looks great. And like I said, he eats a diet consisting mostly of red meat. So we're going to get into some interesting stuff with him. So Sean, first off, you know, like I said, you've got a really interesting background. Can we go into a little bit of your athletic history and also your military service?
Yeah, sure. Athletically, I've kind of hung around the strength circles for a lot of years. I started out kind of in college playing rugby, I kind of bloomed late athletically because I was pretty thin, and I started lifting and kind of got the size on it. And I started playing rugby. I ended up, getting recruited to play down in New Zealand, and I got to play in this Premier League where we played against some of the top players in the world. A lot of the New Zealand All Blacks were in the league we got to play against. And then I kind of shifted into powerlifting, and I set several records in different powerlifting organizations, primarily with a deadlift. My best deadlift was a 772-pound deadlift as a drug-free athlete. That was probably when I was about early 30s I did that. Then I shifted into I did strongman stuff for a few years, played with that for a while, enjoyed that. And then I shifted on into throwing, where I ended up winning I was over 40 at the time, so I ended up winning the Highland Games Masters World Championships in throwing. I went back to powerlifting and I broke a national record in deadlift again. Over, I think I had a 711-pound deadlift at 40 years of age. And then when I got tired of being too damn big, I slimmed down and started doing this indoor rowing stuff. And so now I've broken several U.S. and world records on the rowing machine as well now. So that's where I'm at currently.
How big were you while you were doing the strongman and the Highland Games and the throwing?
I averaged about 280. I spent about 20 years around 280 pounds, and for powerlifting, you're at 6'5", you're not going to be a 198-pound class guy. Yeah. Same thing with Highland Games. You've got to be, and I was a little guy, quite honestly, at 6'5", 280, I was not one of the bigger guys. I mean, a lot of those guys are 6'8", 320, 340. I mean, you have to be really big to counter those weights. So it's just a sport that requires size. And then now that I'm not doing that stuff, I'm happy to be a relatively skinny 240 pounder.
Absolutely. I used to be a lot heavier than I am now. And I just remember bending over to try to tie my shoes and getting out of breath. And it's not fun. It's not fun. It looks good, but it's not fun. What was your diet like back then? What were you eating at that point?
Well, I mean, I was eating what, most people would consider the normal recommended diet, lots of fruits and vegetables and lean dairy. And, I was eating meat and I was eating a lot of cereals and stuff, lots of yogurt. I remember that. So I'd have some desserts up as well. I'd say just a high volume of food, though. That's kind of what I was doing. I wasn't eating I wasn't eating potato chips and a lot of junk food, but it was just high volumes of, what normally people would think is relatively healthy.
Lots of carbs, lots of proteins, some good fats. Yeah. And like that's
exactly. Yeah.
And so what years did you begin serving in the Air Force?
So I went in, let me try to think here. So I was kind of funny. I was in medical school and then I left to play rugby in the middle of medical school, which is kind of weird. And then when I came back, I didn't want to stop playing rugby. Mm-hmm. It was in the early 90s. And so the best place to play rugby in the United States at that time was in the military because they had a pretty good program. So I went into the military in my early 20s. I went to the officer, officer training system. And then I ended up in there from about 92 to 97. And then when I got tired of playing rugby, I was a nuclear weapons launch officer back then, stationed up in Wyoming. I did my training out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. And I was up in Cheyenne, Wyoming for a while at Warren Air Force Base. But I was playing rugby. I remember I was laying on a pile playing a team of Russians and I was getting my head kicked in. I had blood coming out of my ears. And I finally said, well, I'm tired of this. And so I ended up going back to medical school and the military was kind enough to pay for that. So I finished out my training, did the civilian training, civilian residency. And then I came back in 2006 and then I was in for 5 years. And that's when I got sent to Afghanistan to do a bunch of this, trauma surgery, during the Afghan war's going on. That's where I was, did all that sort of stuff.
That must have been rough as far as the amount of surgeries you had to do and the way the op tempo was going. How was that for you?
Yeah, I mean, we were at a little facility called Bagram. I'm sure some of your guys know where that is, and that was the main hub. And so, I think Kandahar and Bagram are the two main medical facilities, but the main U.S. one's up in Bagram. And so we got all the, all the secondary trauma, all the stuff that came from the field got sent to us, and then we got all the fresh trauma that was in the local area. So we were busy. I mean, I don't think there was a single day we didn't operate while we were there. And it was, it was a lot. It was probably 4 to 5 times what you'd see on a normal day if you're a regular surgeon. I mean, we were constantly just, taking care of casualties, unfortunately. Unfortunately we were needed. I wish we didn't have to be, but it was U.S. guys. It was coalition guys. It was Afghan army, civilians. And we even took care of some of the bad guys, So, I mean, just whatever came in, we ended up, taking care of all that stuff.
Wow. When, I always wondered with surgeons, how, given the long hours that you guys work, how you're able to cognitively get through a surgery, some of these complex surgeries that you do, as far as, on very little sleep and very little energy or anything like that. Were you doing any kind of special diet tricks back then when you were going through this to give you more energy or?
No, I mean, I was just eating, I was going to the DFACs and the dining facilities and just kind of picking it out. I still trained at the time, it was a very, we predictably knew we were going to be busy with trauma surgery, but even despite that, we still had a routine. It was get up, operate all through the day, get something to eat, get a training session, and then you try to get some sleep. And sometimes you could get decent sleep. Sometimes you get, you get woken up with a lot of trauma, so it kind of rotated. But that's how you train as a surgeon anyway. I mean, it's kind of, you don't get much sleep. And so you're kind of used to that. Not saying that's the best way to do it. That's just the way it's done. And so, the other thing is once you're, it's like anything, if your adrenaline is up, it tends to keep you focused. And I think that's what happens. So you sleep pretty, when you go to sleep, you crash out. I mean, when you hit the rack, it's, within about 10 seconds you're asleep. And then, you kind of get as much as you possibly can, basically.
Absolutely. So, moving on into toward the nutrition realm, how did you come across doing a ketogenic diet first? Because I all through the 90s, all through the early part of the 2000s, everyone was like, you can't build muscle without carbs, you can't build strength without carbs. How did you come across a ketogenic diet, and when did you start doing it yourself?
Yeah, so when I got in my mid-40s, like I said, I'm 51 now, but when I got in my mid-40s, I started to notice it. I was retaining weight that I couldn't get rid of. I was getting issues with blood pressure, probably developing sleep apnea. I was still about 280 then. And I just kind of made the decision that, I was probably pre-diabetic if I would have tested myself. I didn't, but I probably would have been, but I made the decision that, I've got to change my diet, because my philosophy before was, just train your ass off and you can, you can outwork any diet. And that was that had worked pretty well for me for many decades, but then it stopped working. And so then I had to kind of come up with a different strategy. So I went on a low calorie, low fat, almost a vegetarian diet for a while, and I got skinnier. I lost some weight. I was exercising like a maniac, like 3 times a day. Before when I got in the morning, when I got up in the morning, I was jumping rope a couple thousand times, working out at my lunch hour, and then going back home at night and jumping rope again. But it wasn't sustainable, man. I was not a happy camper, kind of pissed off and not in a, not something I could sustain. I mean, I had the discipline to do it, but I just wasn't enjoying it. So then I just started reading more about different diets. I slipped into a paleo diet for a while, did that for about a year, felt pretty good with that. Then I just kind of continued to read, and then I finally made my way into a ketogenic diet, which I spent about 2 years doing that, and actually felt pretty good. I enjoyed it, and then I kind of transitioned on what I'm doing now. So,
were you doing like the strict version of keto, like the 80-10-10? Were you modifying it at all or anything like that?
No, I mean I wasn't. Like I said, I wasn't like measuring ketones or anything like that. I mean, I generally, had a macro ratio where I was probably about 80% fat most of the time. I was eating, the standard, I wasn't eating a bunch of junk food. I was eating, you know, the salads, the spinach, you know, it was a lot of, you know, a lot of bacon and eggs, you know, there was some meat, there was some salmon in there, you know, a few nuts and stuff like that. Occasionally I make some of the fat bombs and stuff like that, but I wasn't like, you know, calculating stuff. I just, you know, I just find that stuff gets, you know, it gets old pretty quick. You know, life doesn't necessarily give you the opportunity that discipline all the time as far as, you know, sort of that stuff. I just, you know, and I felt pretty good, quite honestly. I didn't feel bad on keto. And I was doing reasonably well in the gym. I was still getting stronger. That's how that worked for me.
Yeah. I, as far as keto goes, I think that, a lot of times it's the fear of reducing the carbs and getting rid of the carbs that affects people more than anything, that mental attachment to them. When I first went to keto, I did so out of desperation. I had ulcerative colitis. Literally the only thing I could digest was coconut oil, some red meat and some vegetables. I had to get rid of all the other stuff I was eating, and I thought I was going to get super skinny. But the opposite started happening. I started, you know, putting on muscle. I started getting leaner. I started feeling better, thinking better, performing better. So it's interesting how the human body works like that. And it's interesting how so many people have this fear, this attachment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like I said, we have a lot of that fear and attachment is just kind of almost tradition. It's not really based on any good evidence. And so I think what we're seeing now with, you know, more and more people doing ketogenic diets and, you know, now even people doing these carnivorous diets, that we're seeing that a lot of those, you know, dogmatic things we've always thought were important may not be really required. And so it's been an interesting journey. I'm learning stuff new every single day, and the more people I interact with it doing these different things, it's pretty opening. It's, you know, it's kind of almost mind blowing to see some of this stuff happening.
Yeah. And I think it's also timely because the medical establishment's pretty much been failing us for so long. As far as you look at the rates of diabetes, the rates of obesity in this country, the amount of veterans in the veteran community who have diabetes, we're talking about it before the show, but 1 in 4 veterans is in the VA system has diabetes. And they're saying that a third of our population here in the United States is going to be pre-diabetic within the next 10 years. That's billions of dollars. Billions of dollars going to healthcare and a lot of people who are going to be hurting really, really bad.
Yeah. And unfortunately, and I totally in agreement with you about the healthcare, we certainly let people down, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily the fault of the physicians. It's just the way the system is set up. We're set up for, you know, dealing with the disasters after they've already occurred. We don't do a very good job of preventing that stuff. And we certainly have the resources, and if we had the will and the, if we were incentivized correctly, that would work. Unfortunately, the incentive is placed, for just symptom management and, you know, putting band-aids on stuff. And so we can certainly prevent that. You know, the other thing that I think is, I know you talked about the diabetes statistics, but I mean, diabetes is just a, you know, it's kind of a canary in the coal mine. I mean, that represents chronic disease. And I think the same issues generally that are leading to the diabetes epidemic are leading to all these other increases in all these other things, whether it be heart disease, cancer. And the big one that's coming up is dementia. You know, we're going to have a population where we have a huge number of demented people. And I know we touched on mental health, and that's also growing. And so I think all the things that lead us to get diabetes lead those other things to happen too. And I think the, you know, well, we can talk about what I think the solutions for that are, but that's definitely coming, and it's scary, and I think it's gonna be very costly, and it's gonna bankrupt us if we don't turn the ship around.
Absolutely, I definitely want to talk about those solutions. One thing I want to mention, particularly for this audience, is the idea of brain inflammation and dementia being something huge coming up down the line. You know, particularly for those of us who spent a lot of our teens and 20s around explosives, around gunshots and things like that. Each one of those explosions, we've had Dr. Mark Gordon on the show, he's talked about each one of those explosions creating, you know, shocks within the brain that vibrate the brain and eventually create inflammation, and that reduces or completely shuts down our production of neurosteroids, which is going to lead to higher brain inflammation and dementia down the line. So a lot of us listening to this podcast right now,
we've got to be really careful with our brains and really put every effort we can into taking care of our brains if we want to avoid these problems down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I think what you have is, you know, there's situations where you are predisposed or your body has a background level of inflammation. And I think diet plays a big role in that. And I think these other insults, you know, they just compound the issue. And so, you know, if you've already got a traumatic brain injury, or you've got, you know, like we talked about, post-traumatic stress disorder, where you're exposed to all this trauma, you know, maybe psychological, it still has an impact on the biology of your brain. And so I think you need to do everything to support that. And I think diet has a huge role in that, and probably it's been much underappreciated, and it's only starting to get talked about now. But I think that's a crucial pillar of how you kind of prevent and treat some of this stuff.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Now, so you were doing the ketogenic diet for a while. When did you decide to go complete carnivore?
Yeah. So I've done that now for just over a year. Last December, so December 2016, you know, I was overseas with some relatives. I had my last vegetable. I thought I was going to do it. I'd been playing with it a little bit, you know, a few months before that, doing a week or two here and there. And then, you know, kind of after Christmas holidays, I said, well, I'm going to do this now for a 30-day stretch just to try it. And I mean, I just really, really felt good about it. You know, my health felt really good. I mean, there's a little bit of transition stuff, but I mean, I'd had some minor things that were still kind of giving me a little bit of trouble, like some joint pain and stuff like that, some tendon pain. And I'm still very much a competitive athlete, and I wanted to kind of continue to, you know, do what I ever can to get healthy, faster, and stronger. And so I just noticed that started to happen. And so after 30 days, I said, well, my 30 days is up. I'm going to go back to my ketogenic diet. You know, I did that, and I just, quite honestly, just didn't feel very good, you know, as good. And so I, you know, I noted that, you know, for about a week after I did a day of ketogenic diet, and for a week, I just didn't feel very good at night. So I immediately switched back to a all meat diet. I just kept going. And here I am, you know, over a year later, and still going strong, and still getting healthier and faster and stronger. And, you know, that's the way it is.
And what kind of issues were you having when you came back to it? Was it like general aches and pains?
It was almost as though, you know, there was a general increase in inflammation, and it was, you know, a little bit of GI upset. You know, there was a little bit of just overall malaise where you don't feel good, and a little bit of, you know, joint pain. You know, that's just what I noticed. And I said, well, you know, there's something in the diet that's irritating me, and it's not meat, you know, because meat I was tolerating extremely well. And so I said, well, I'm just going to stick to that. And, you know, I'm not a person that, you know, lives off of, you know, that lives to eat. I just, you know, it's the other way, you know, I kind of eat to live and eat to perform. And so it wasn't a big sacrifice for me. And I just felt, you know, much better. So that's where I am.
And so what does this diet look like? Is it, you know, are you eating meat throughout the day? Are you waiting? Are you fasting? What's the layout like?
Yeah. So it's very intuitive. You know, I eat when I'm hungry, basically, which is, you know, it sounds crazy, but that's when I eat, you know, like any other animal on the planet. I eat till I'm full, and then I eat again when I'm hungry again. So what that does for me, is it works out to typically two meals a day. Some days it's one, some days it's three, but I would say 95% of the time I'm eating two meals a day. I'm a big guy, so I eat quite a bit. You know, I'm training pretty hard most days. And so, you know, it might be a couple steaks in the morning and a couple steaks in the afternoon. Or it might be, you know, some hamburger patties. Very rarely I'll throw in a couple eggs. You know, I usually maybe add a couple eggs to dish. And then once in a while I'll take in a little seafood. It might be shrimp or salmon or something like that. And then, you know, when I first started, I had more variety. It's kind of funny. As you get into this farther and farther, you start to, you know, it just becomes food and it doesn't become entertainment. So you kind of like the same thing over and over. But initially I was doing a lot more dairy than I do now. You know, I was doing some heavy cream still and a little bit of cheese. And I find that I rarely, you know, I rarely do that anymore just because for me, it just kind of, it makes me feel not quite as good. So I just kind of admitted that. So right now, I mean, you know, 90% of the time my day is just steak, you know?
Okay. Yeah. And I want to ask you some questions about that too. First, have you been taking your blood markers? Have you been monitoring your numbers and things like that? As far as, I'm not necessarily worried about cholesterol, but like C-reactive protein, and some of the other things as far as nutrients and minerals.
Yeah. So this is, and I've got a long discussion on this if you want to, but the short answer is, I just drew my blood yesterday, you know, as I just kind of passed the 1 year point. So I'll have some results next week probably, but I haven't been routinely monitoring that. And the one issue and people have a hard time wrapping their head around this, even as a physician that says this, unfortunately, the blood markers that we often rely on, they're extremely variable and they can change, you know, in a matter of a few days. So they're not really great markers for, you know, to determining disease or determining, you know, status and stuff. A lot of them, you know, the mineral and vitamin levels in blood, we're not sure how accurate they are. We know things like cholesterol. You know, there's a guy named Dave Feldman who's demonstrating that you can change your cholesterol 100 points in a week, which is just mind blowing. You know, because you go in once a year, get your cholesterol test, and they'll say, you know, yeah, it's 220. Let's put you on Lipitor or some other statin. And I mean, literally a week later, it could be 120. And so it's, you know, I think we have to revisit how useful that is. And quite honestly, you know, cholesterol, in a lot of cases, people think higher cholesterol is better. So that's unclear to me, you know, like some of these other things like, you know, C-reactive protein, you know, I've drawn these labs, so we'll see what they are. But, you know, quite honestly, C-reactive protein is another one. You know, if you've exercised hard, you know, within you know, a day or so before getting your labs drawn, it could artificially elevate that. Same thing with your liver enzyme. So all these things that we sort of think are great markers for disease, you know, it just is really context dependent. So, and the other thing is, you know, people on low carb diets or ketogenic diet or carnivorous diets, a lot of the normal lab ranges, one particular is like thyroid hormone. We suspect that a lot of those things, those requirements actually go down. So if your thyroid level is lower on a low carb diet, it doesn't necessarily mean you're hypothyroid or suffering from problems. It just might mean that you don't require as much circulating thyroid hormone. So we don't know that yet. So we have to kind of reestablish normal values in these populations, because all the all the standard reference ranges for labs, all the recommended requirements for vitamins and minerals were determined on high carb populations. And so we don't even know if we're comparing apples to oranges or apples to apples when we look at labs. So that's the one reservation I have about this. But you know, a lot of people just can't get that out of their mind that they have to have a lab to show them they're healthy. And my thing is, you know, what is your mood like? What's your energy level like? What's your libido like? What's your joint pain like? What's your digestion like? What's your skin health like? You know, what's your ability to put on muscle and train, your capacity to exercise? Those things to me are better markers of health than a lab value. Now, you can get some advanced imaging studies like coronary artery calcium scan or, you know, some tissue biopsies or some other things that might be more useful. But you got to remember, your blood values change sometimes day to day and sometimes even hourly. So I don't get too excited about those things.
Yeah, the whole cholesterol thing, I mean, I think that doctors are even coming out now and saying it's just a useless marker as far as things go. And I completely agree with you there. I do get worried about calcium buildup and things like that. And as far as inflammation goes which we're seeing, you know, we're starting to understand a little bit more about how heart disease happens with calcification of the arteries and veins and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, but you would see that on a coronary artery calcium scan, or you know, you could look at your carotid arteries. You know, it's not the calcium's bad or anything like that. But yes, what our body does in cases of damage, you know, we lay down calcium. Same thing with bone. I mean, when bone is anything bad that happens to bone, it'll lay down extra calcium. And so it's whether it's a fracture, whether it's an infection, whether it's a tumor. Typically, a lot of times, you know, one of the things it'll do is it'll lay down bone. We see that calcifications in the blood vessels, you know, when the blood vessels are inflamed and injured, you know, the body will try to put calcium in there. Same thing with muscles. You know, there's a condition called myositis ossificans, where there's a traumatized muscle, and it can lay down calcium. Sometimes that's mistaken for a tumor. But yeah, you're right. Calcium, it's not the calcium circulating in your blood is a bad thing. Maybe your calcium's not going to indicate right. That, but where it's deposited. But again, you're not going to get that on a blood test.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's talk about some of these other things as far as the diet goes. So you're eating mostly muscle meat, right? So we're talking about like ribeye steaks and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, most people, and again, I'm not the only guy doing this. There are literally thousands upon thousands of people doing it, you know, mm-hmm. that are kind of Western society people. And then historically there were all kinds of work populations that largely did this, but, most people will find they gravitate toward the fattier cuts of meat. I could get some, you know, I think people are discovering on a ketogenic diet that you need enough fat in your diet. And you, I mean, you can't live on skinny chicken breasts and cans of tuna for a long period of time. You just get sick doing that. But, you know, most people will gravitate to fattier cuts of meat. Many people include organ meats. I don't think they're necessary. I mean, I haven't done that. There's a lot of people that don't do that. You're just fine. You know, I don't think it's necessary to buy grass finished beef. I mean, you can do just as well with the conventional stuff. So, you know, because some people talk about cost, and in my experience, you know, that has not been a big difference as far as health goes. And so if you're somebody's considering doing this and you're like, man, I can't afford the best organic beef, you don't have to. I mean, that's not what I do. I mean, 98% of my diet is beef, you know, steak I get at the grocery store. You know, that's not the really, I get buy the stuff on sale and it works just as well.
I got to send you my recipe for grass-fed beef liver. I make this thing, it tastes like a steak. I'm not kidding you. My girlfriend loves it too. And she wasn't a liver eater growing up or anything. But, you know, that I do try to include a lot of organ meats into my diet just because of the nutrient density and the, you know, they're awesome as far as cost goes because nobody else wants to eat the liver. I get like a couple of pounds of it for under $5.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't mistake me for saying you shouldn't eat that stuff. If you like it, go ahead. And you're right, it can be a very cost value. And yes, it is nutrient dense. You know, the only question is, you know, we talk about nutrient density. We've got to realize how much is enough and when does it become overkill. And so a lot of people think that you have to get the most of every single nutrient in every single bite. And when reality is, it's your body needs a certain amount and that's it. It doesn't need much beyond that. So I think you're getting that in what I'm eating. Now, if you have some nutrient deficiencies ahead of time and you want to try to, and you know what they are, and you've got this documented stuff, you may do that for a while. That may make you feel better for a while, but I don't think that's something you chronically need to do all the time.
Okay. And so what about the gut microbiome as far as, you know, feeding the friendly bacteria with fibrous vegetables or green leafy vegetables or treatment resistant or resistant starch? What would you say about that?
Yeah, again, that is more speculation than it is facts. You know, I think what we're seeing is we've got this belief system that you know, vegetables and fruits and these other things and fiber is somehow good for us. And that's really based on just kind of this really weakly confounded epidemiology. And so what we're doing is we're seeing populations in which, you know, people that eat a lot of fruits and vegetables and fiber tend to live longer and have less diseases in some epidemiologic studies. But what they do is they always, you know, those people that generally do that generally are healthier. I mean, they are generally more health conscious. They go to the doctor, they exercise more, they don't smoke, they don't drink, you know, they're just more health conscious people. And so they have that population. And so they don't know how to, you know, which one of those factors is actually causing the improvement in their health. So they kind of say, well, all of them are good. So it must be the vegetables, and the fruit, and the fiber. And so they try to justify it. So the latest thing is, you know, as you probably know, the microbiome, our interest in the microbiome over the last several years has really taken off. We're discovering that, you know, it impacts a number of systems, whether it's overall health or even mental health. But one of the things is it's we don't really know for sure. I mean, we're decades, if even not longer, away from knowing for sure what is the exact healthy microbiome. And I would argue that it's going to change, you know, extremely frequently based on different situations. We know things that affect it are things like sleep and stress and what your diet is and how much exercise you had, what's the time of the year, and all these other environmental things that change it continuously. We also know that, and how old you are. And so all these things are going to impact your microbiome. And so we can't possibly say, you know, we can't give you a test and say you have a healthy microbiome and you don't. Now, we can pick out some pathological organisms for sure, but it's too premature to say, you know, you're not healthy because you have X, Y, and Z bacteria and you don't have, you know, A, B, and C. The better way to look at this is, you know, if you are healthy, if you're exhibiting all sorts of indicators of health, then probably the microbiome that you have is the right one for you and it's a healthy one for you. I mean, that's probably the best way to look at this. And so you don't need these probiotics to tailor your, you know, they probably don't even work in the first place, but that you don't need to tailor your microbiome based on some preconceived notion of health as it doesn't exist. And people that are trying to tell you that or trying to sell you a supplement, and they're just basically conning you out of some money. The other thing is, you know, we've talked about, you know, feeding the good bacteria. Well, here's an interesting thing. You've got ulcerative colitis, and I will tell you, and people with Crohn's disease or irritable bowel syndrome, they'll find that when they cut all fiber out of their diet and go on basically a whole meat diet, and there's a researcher out of Hungary, her name is Zofia Clemens, and her partner, Saba Toth, are studying these diseases, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and they're getting tremendous success in people that are going on what they are calling the Paleolithic ketogenic diet, which is basically an all meat diet in these cases. And they are getting complete remission of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, and people have been suffering on it for years when they eliminate, you know, things like fruits and vegetables and other fiber sources. And so fiber is inherently irritating to the intestines. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that will, you know, when they go on a high fiber diet, it's uncomfortable. They're bloated, they get gas, you know, their intestines hurt. Their digestion is not a pleasant process. And so one of the reasons people talk about feeding the microbiome is because when your intestines lay down a layer of mucus, you know, we say, well, that's good. It's protecting us from bacteria. But what it's really doing, if you think about it, if you have mucus in your lungs, you know, that's not really a good thing. The reason you have mucus in your lungs building up is because you've been exposed to an irritant, whether it's cigarette smoke or pollution or some kind of virus. You'll have a bunch of mucus and you'll have coughing that stuff up. And the same thing happens in our intestinal linings. We produce mucus to protect us from irritating substances. And what that irritating substance is, in many cases, is fiber. And so what happens is, you know, you eat a bunch of fiber, you make a bunch of mucus to protect you from the fiber, but then there's bacteria that like to eat the fiber. And so you know, and rather having them eat the fiber than the mucus, it's kind of a circular logic, because if you don't eat the fiber, then you don't need the mucus. But if you do eat the fiber, you need the mucus. And so it's kind of like, if you're going to eat fiber and you're going to eat junk food, then you probably need to eat fiber to keep the mucus there. But if you're only going to do like meat and you're not eating fiber, then arguably you don't need to do that stuff.
Yeah. I think, I definitely agree with you on the fruit front. I'm not a fan of eating a lot of fruit or anything like that. I do include a lot of green vegetables in my diet, and I found it does tend to help with the ulcerative colitis when I'm consuming a good amount of green vegetables. I actually eat a lot of green vegetables, probably around 8 to 10 cups a day. But I think what you're saying is really, really interesting. And I think that the idea that we don't know everything about the gut microbiome, that's really interesting as well. You know, I've talked to like Dr. Rodney Dieter, who wrote the book, The Human Superorganism. He's doing some really cool research, like actually looking at the way drugs interact with the gut microbiome, like certain drugs can't work without it. And then looking at the different stuff. The one thing we do know though, is that sugar can completely wreck it. Like it can completely ruin your digestive system, that it can completely throw that system out of balance and cause tons of sugar cravings, brain fog, and all the nasty stuff we're talking about. But I also know that you're compiling a bunch of data as well with people who are doing this diet, right?
Yeah, we started something called N equals Many. We started World Carnivore Month, which is another attempt to gather more data. So we're getting, you know, we're still analyzing stuff, still gathering that stuff, but we're getting into the, you know, many, many hundreds and maybe even over 1,000 people that are going to be submitting data, and we'll continue to do that, you know, try to build a database. We've got a lot of, you know, we've got a lot of anecdotal stuff and subjective stuff that we've got results on, but we're encouraging people to get lab data for us. I just did a podcast the other day with a guy named Ryan Muncy, and he did his microbiome, and you know, the results were, you know, you have a really good microbiome, you know, whatever that really means, you know, like I said, you know, and you're correct. You know, we've been studying the microbiome for not that long. We've been studying cholesterol for 6 decades and we still don't know what the hell to do with it. So, I mean, it's premature to say that, you know, the microbiome, we know everything about, we just do not. And you're right. Sure. Probably negatively affects it, but it negatively affects everything else. So it goes back to, if you're sick from eating sugar, you know, probably your microbiome is sick too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as far as the way you do your diet, and this is the other thing I find, I think that's fascinating to me is the idea that you are fasting quite a bit and you are, you're fasting and then eating a large amount of food. And I think the health implications of fasting as well
are so fascinating to me and so remarkable as far as things they can do for cellular health, things they can do as far as improving digestion, giving the digestive system a rest, and I think that there could be a huge impact there. Is there, do you think there's any kind of confounding variables between fasting and just eating meat?
Well, I think I agree with you. And here's the way I like to approach this. I think that we were imbued with an appetite for a reason. So when you're hungry, you should probably eat. Now, what happens with me is I'm just not hungry. It's not that I'm saying I'm going to eat a meal and I'm going to wait, 18.7 hours before my next meal. I'm not putting a stopwatch down, but what is happening is I'm just not hungry. And so I've got this long interdigestive period. And we know that there are some likely good things occur, whether you want to talk about autophagy or, autophagy just means you're eating, your cells are eating themselves or just turning over, structures that aren't, that are damaged or need to be turned over. And so I think those things definitely are happening. I prefer the term intermittent feasting. Because that's what I'm doing. I'm feasting. And I think that lines up better with what happened, evolutionarily. I mean, I think that's what animals do. They eat when they're hungry, and then they don't eat again until they're hungry again. Now you can argue that, especially carnivorous animals that hunt, they're not always successful at hunting. But it's not to say that, if they would have caught an animal, they wouldn't have sat there and said, "Oh, wait, it's not time to eat yet." I mean, they're trying to eat when they're hungry, and I think humans did that too. And I think that, looking back historically, humans were at some point very good hunters, and we were in a world where there were lots and lots of these megafauna animals that populated the earth until we basically wiped them out. And so when we use these modern hunter-gatherer societies, they're living in a different world. They don't have the big mammoths and all these other creatures that roam that we are good at killing around. And so I think they probably don't eat as much as what we did before. And I think what happened is probably humans just pigged out, ate as much as they could, and then when I got hungry, they ate again. I think that's, it's not socially acceptable. It doesn't win you any awards at tea parties, but I think that's how, we're wired. And I do think what happens, I think what naturally happens on a carnivorous diet is you go to one or two meals a day, you eat a whole bunch of meat, and you end up not eating again for a long period of time. And if you want to call that fasting, that's fine. I call that just not eating again until I'm hungry. And I think that's the difference. It's a subtle difference there. I think when you get hungry, if you're only eating one thing, just think about the logic behind this. If you're only eating one thing, why are you hungry again? What is your body trying to tell you? And my argument is your body is telling you, hey, I need some structural materials because I got to build some more stuff. And I also need some energy. And so I just eat. And a lot of times you're right. It can be 12 hours, 16 hours, 18, or even 24 hours that I do that. But it's not that I'm not intentionally not eating when I'm hungry. And when I'm hungry, I eat. It's just that the natural rhythm of eating this way puts you in a situation where you don't eat that often.
As far as liquids, how much water are you drinking a day?
My answer would be enough.
Yeah.
I drink quite a bit. I would say I drink probably more than I did before, but I'm not like calculating. I just, when I'm thirsty, I drink. And I think, ingesting more protein will increase your water requirements. I think that's it's arguably, when you cook your meat, meat by itself is about 70% water by weight. So if you're eating raw meat, you'd be actually taking in a lot of water. Animals, a lot of times, if they can't, they'll eat, carnivorous animals will eat animal flesh. It's raw. It contains about 70% by water, and they won't often have to drink that often. But for me, since I'm cooking my food, I drink, I would guess at least a gallon a day, if not more, probably. But I don't know for sure.
And are you salt when you cook up a steak? Are you salting it? Are you adding spices and things like that?
Yeah, currently, like I said, I've been into this for about a year now. And so the things I did at the beginning are not what I do now. Right now, all I do is put a little salt on my steak, and that's all I really want. I think for me, particularly since I'm exercising pretty heavily still, I seem to crave salt more. And I think that's, again, it's another thing that our bodies are able at sensing. We have very good ways of sensing what our serum sodium level is. And so we have these feedback mechanisms to know when we're thirsty, to know when we need salt, to know when we need to eat. So that's what I do. When I initially started, because, when people hear this stuff, they say, how can you just eat the same thing over and over again? And how do you live without variety? When I started, you know, I was definitely including more variety. So I was putting garlic and butter and salt and pepper and, you know, a few other spices here and there. That for me, the desire to do that for me, by about 2 months in, I just felt like, you know, I really just enjoy the flavor of the ribeye steak or the T-bone or whatever I'm eating, or the hamburger even. So I just kind of got away from that. But right now, day to day, I mean, I don't take any supplements at all. You know, I just, you know, eat some steak with a little water, drink with a little salt and drink water, and that's it. You know, I don't take drugs. I don't take testosterone, any of those things. So I'm just kind of to the bare bones of what's required for human nutrition, I think.
Now, as far as training goes, what's your training like currently?
So, you know, right. Well, the last few weeks has been pretty fragmented because I've been traveling quite a bit, but I mean, my general training scheme is, you know, like I said, there are a number of things, you know, as a 51-year-old guy now that I want to preserve, as just, you know, for health, but as far as athletic ability. So I want to maintain strength. So I do some compound strength movements, squats, deadlifts, some kind of pushing, you know, pressing exercise pretty frequently, you know, once, you know, probably about twice a week. I do some high level conditioning, a lot of, you know, interval conditioning type stuff. You know, as you know, I'm still competing on a Concept 2 rower, so I'll do quite a bit of rowing. And then the other thing that I do that a lot of people tend to neglect is I do a lot of sprinting. Even though I'm in my 50s, I'll be out running hill sprints. And then I do a lot of jumping and throwing and explosivity type training. So a lot of med ball slams, med ball throws, and, you know, all kinds of hard med ball stuff. I do a lot of heavy kettlebell swings. And so that's kind of how I, you know, kind of try to take care of everything I think is important to maintain. You know, I think for years, everybody was just into jogging, and now people are finally starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, you need to do some strength training, and then now they're getting a little bit more conditioned. But I think also that ability to run and jump and to accelerate, you know, even at my age is important, you know, and hopefully I'll be able to continue to do that for decades to come.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing more and more people as they're getting older, seeing so many benefits from strength training. I think, if there's one thing I've done that's benefited my life more than anything, it was starting to go to the gym when I was 12 years old. I think, gave me confidence, allowed me to do a lot of things. I'm 38 today, and I feel really, really good, better than I did back, when I was in my early 30s and competing in bodybuilding, and simply because I've continued to strength training after that. So that's pretty awesome. So what's next with you? What have you been working on? I know you have Carnivore Strength Systems up. I know that you've been running this N equals many experiment. Where are you going next? What are you going to do?
Yeah, so I think, well, right now, I mean, carnivoretrainingsystem.com is where I'm doing, helping people train and helping transition to this type of diet. Probably a book will come out of this, you know, probably hopefully later this year. You know, I'm doing a lot of just talking, probably do some speaking engagements. I know some people want me to speak at some conferences, so I'll probably start doing some of that. I may start part-time practicing medicine, although my sort of passion is sort of gone on the prevention side, so I'm not sure how much I'll do that. You know, I've got a lot of different sort of people asking me to do stuff right now, so I'm not sure how to do that. I've actually got an agent now to try to help me with all this stuff that's coming.
Big time, so, big time.
So he's going to help me kind of maybe make market kind of a brand, I guess, if you'd say, and just try to hopefully be able to make a living helping people besides cutting people over open with, you know, with surgery. And that's what I'd ultimately like to do. But we'll see. What I think this year is going to be interesting for me. I don't know where it's going to end up. Like I said, every single day I get somebody saying, hey, you want to do this? Do you want to do that? I'm just trying to weigh through the pros and cons and see what, you know, where my energy allows me to go and where my resources allow me to go.
Yeah. That's always so many decisions to make when you're coming into something like this. I want to talk about Carnivore Training Systems. So when somebody signs up for Carnivore Training Systems, like what's included in the membership? What do they get?
Yeah, so it's basically a 12-week training course. And so basically what I do is I walk them through the transition into how to do a carnivore diet. I talk to them about the intricacies of that, some of the common issues, you know, some of the common concerns. So there's a bunch of videos on that stuff. And then I've got a whole series of exercises that I describe how to set up a home training program or a gym training program, whatever's convenient for you. You know, we kind of tailor it for different people with different abilities. So there's people that are higher level that want to come to versus people that are maybe dealing with an injury or just have an exercise in a long period of time. So we go through that. You know, there's detailed workouts, you know, typically 3 or 4 workouts a week. They come out every week. So once you start, you get the first week and then you get the second week. And then what I do is I do live feedback sessions, usually about a couple times a week. So I just say, hey, we're going to do a live feedback session at this hour. And then whoever wants to come in and ask questions, I can answer any questions. People send me, you know, videos of what's going on. I'll critique whatever I think it needs to be critiqued. And so it's what I do is, because I'm on social media quite a bit, I'm always getting questions on, you know, what do I do, how do I do this? And so it's just a way for me to interact more, you know, more thoroughly with people than trying to tweet out an answer or put it out in an Instagram post. And so but that's the gist. And then we talk about some of the mental aspect of it too, because I think, you know, you've got to have a, there's a certain psychology to getting healthy, you know, even if it's just minor stuff. I think that's a big role. You know, I've, like I said, I've broken a lot of records in different sports. And so, you know, there's a certain mindset that goes with that. But I mean, just generally, you know, deciding to take charge of your life and take charge of your health requires some mental investment. And so we kind of talk about that stuff too.
Absolutely. The mental side's probably almost greater than anything else, especially when it comes to dieting, because people tend to lose their minds a little bit. Sometimes I think it's that there's so much information out there that people just want to jump from thing to thing to thing, and they don't give things enough time and enough consistency.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, like I said, and I'm another guy putting more information out there that maybe confuse people even more. And I tell people, you know, you can read all the research papers in the world, you know, and they change, and a lot of them, they just change the next year, their conclusions change, and none of the experts even agree on what they mean. And so it's really hard to decide what you do. Even as a physician who's had a lot of experience with literature and you know, medicine and stuff like that, it's still very confusing, even to people like me and some of the others. And so you really have to, you know, really apply to yourself whatever metric you want to use and be consistent with it and objective about it. And then just see what actually works for you. And really, you know, one of the nice things about doing a carnivorous diet is, you know, when you're wondering what in your diet is helping and hurting you, when you're only eating basically one food, you really find how to eliminate different variables. And the other thing that we touched upon a couple of times is mental health. You know, I'm finding, again, I'm just giving these, we started another website called meatheals.com. You know, it's basically stories of people that have brain health in various aspects, from either being fully carnivorous or highly carnivorous. And one of the areas we're seeing a lot of improvement in is actually mental health, which is really fascinating to me. A lot of people are talking about how their depression was going away, the mental fog is going away, their anxiety is going away. And so there may be applications to God, perhaps with PTSD and stuff like that, this could be a benefit to. And so it's just worth exploring, I think.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, Sean, you know, one, I want to thank you for coming on. And two, you know, I think everything you're doing right now is fascinating, and I'm really interested to see where that study goes with everything. I want to ask you, do you have any, you know, single pieces of advice for those guys out there who are listening right now, as far as, you know, what could they do right now to make their lives that much better?
Well, I mean, you know, first, I mean, particularly the military guys, I mean, you just need to realize that you know, you guys are owed a debt of gratitude. And I certainly appreciate the guys that gave more than I did and sacrificed more than I did, and they're suffering from this stuff. But, you know, it's something that, you know, you just have to, you know, you can always improve on your situation. You know, like I tell people, if you can only run, you know, 1 mile an hour, you can run 1.1 miles an hour the next day. You just have to make these incremental steps to get better tomorrow than you were today. Just little by little, you can kind of lift up wherever you are. The other thing is, you know, a lot of the advice I hear is balance and moderation. And to me, that really just means I don't know what to tell you, because that's such weak advice in my view. And so I think you sometimes have to really make a big commitment, even though you may be progressing slowly, but you make a big commitment and stick to that and see where it leads you. And you'll be able to know, you know, when you make these small changes, and I know a lot of people are big fans of this little bitty steps, but I really think that when you make small changes, it's really hard to appreciate if anything happens at all. And so, you know, if you make a small change and you only do it for a month or two, man, nothing may have happened. And so, but if you make a big change, let's say you go crazy and go eat an all meat diet, the big changes tend to show up. The results tend to show up either good or bad pretty quickly. And so you'll know in a couple of weeks, hey man, this is working, or, you know, this is not working. So sometimes you need to make those big changes, and that balance and moderation stuff or the baby step stuff, you know, you never can tell if it even works or not. So that's I think just a general synopsis of, you know, making change, I guess.
Yeah, you can't be afraid to step on your own dick, because you're going to learn one way or the other, right? Sure. So yeah, absolutely. And Sean, thank you so much. Where can people find you online?
Yeah, so I'm getting more. Well, my Instagram account has gotten more lively, just because I guess it's just like a medium, but that's Sean, which is Shawn Baker, Baker, 1967. So that's the year I was born. So Sean Baker, 1967. On Twitter, I'm at S Baker MD. What else we've got? We've got this World Carnivore Month Facebook group that's going right now. We've got, you know, January's World Carnivore Month, so we've got a couple thousand people already, about 3,000 people signed up for that. They're all participating in that. So those are where I'm at right now, depending on when this podcast comes out. We'll probably change the name to that, to the World Carnivore Tribe. I think people want to do that after the month's over. So that's like, that'll be at the end of the month. And then that's, you know, I've got a whole bunch of podcasts coming out and stuff. Like, I know, you'll probably hear a few more me on this coming up in the near future, but that's it for now. We're going to do, actually, there's another website called meatheals.com. So perhaps when this comes out, they'll already be live. So what we're doing is we're just collecting stories. This is all anecdotal stuff. You know, it's not hard science, but still, I think, this is my observation, that powerful stories can really change lives. And I think, you know, I use myself as an example. I mean, I started this crazy thing a year ago, and now here I am on, you know, all kinds of podcasts, Joe Rogan's podcast, because of the story. And I think the story drives, you know, a lot of times the narrative drives people to do things. And what we're finding is more and more people are doing what I'm doing or doing some things similar, and they are getting really good results. And that's inspiring other people. So meatheals.com is a place where we're going to collect these stories, and we're going to categorize them by things like joint pain, digestive health, mental health, you know, skin health, you know, all those things. We're going to try to categorize these different stories where people have triumph over these particular medical conditions using, you know, basically, you know, eating like a carnivore. So it'll be interesting to see. We've already got, you know, hundreds of those already lined up. We just started collecting emails, so we'll have a bunch of them to roll out right away. So it'll be interesting.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks again, Sean. And to everybody out there, we'll be posting up some links on the show notes for how you can get in touch with Sean and follow him on social media. His Instagram account is pretty damn motivating. You see him lifting all kinds of weight, throwing things around, and lots of really delicious looking steaks up there. So you guys take care out there, and wherever you are and whatever you're doing, get out there and live your best lives.